Are you muted, John?
Yep, I guess I was. Okay, thank you. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly call. Today is Monday, May 25th, 2025. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern Time. If you're listening over Rumble or YouTube and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to nationallibertyalliance.org and click on our weekly call for instructions to join us by phone, app, or browser. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions at nationallibertyalliance.org. Please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save our republic. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right side of our website. Okay, we're going to pick up with our scripture reading where we left off last week. We're in the Gospel of Luke, and we're in chapter 6. So the Gospel of Luke, chapter 6, read by Alexander Scorby.
Chapter 7. Now when he had ended all his sayings in the audience of the people, he entered into Capernaum.
Chapter 7.
And a certain centurion's servant, who was dear unto him, was sick and ready to die. And when he heard of Jesus, he sent unto him the elders of the Jews, beseeching him that he would come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they besought him instantly, saying that he was worthy for whom he should do this, for he loveth our nation, and he hath built us a synagogue. Then Jesus went with them. And when he was now not far from the house, the centurion sent friends to him, saying unto him, Lord, trouble not thyself, for I am not worthy that thou shouldest enter under my roof. Wherefore, neither thought I myself worthy to come unto thee. But saying a word, and my servant shall be healed. For I also am a man set under authority, having under me soldiers. And I say unto one, Go, and he goeth, and to another, Come, and he cometh, and to my servant, Do this, and he doeth it. When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him, and turned him about, and said unto the people that followed him, I say unto you, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel. And they that were sent, returning to the house, found the servant whole that had been sick. And it came to pass the day after that he went into a city called Nain, and many of his disciples went with him, and much people. Now when he came nigh to the gate of the city, behold, there was a dead man carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow, and much people of the city was with her. And when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her, and said unto her, Weep not. And he came and touched the bier, and they that bare him stood still. And he said, Young man, I say unto thee, Arise. And he that was dead sat up and began to speak. And he delivered him to his mother. And there came a fear on all, and they glorified God, saying that a great prophet is risen up among us, and that God hath visited his people. And this rumor of him went forth throughout all Judea and throughout all the region round about. And the disciples of John showed him of all these things. And John, calling unto him two of his disciples, sent them to Jesus, saying, Art thou he that should come, or look we for another? When the men were come unto him, they said, John Baptist hath sent us unto thee, saying, Art thou he that should come, or look we for another? And in that same hour he cured many of their infirmities and plagues, and of evil spirits, and unto many that were blind he gave sight. Then Jesus answering said unto them, Go your way, and tell John what things ye have seen and heard, how that the blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, to the poor the gospel is preached. And blessed is he whosoever shall not be offended in me. And when the messengers of John were departed, he began to speak unto the people concerning John. What went ye out into the wilderness for to see? A reed shaken with the wind? But what went ye out for to see? A man clothed in soft raiment? Behold, they which are gorgeously apparelled and live delicately are in kings' courts. But what went ye out for to see? A prophet? Yea, I say unto you, and much more than a prophet. This is he of whom it is written, Behold, I send my messenger before thy face, which shall prepare thy way before thee. For I say unto you, Among those that are born of women, there is not a greater prophet than John the Baptist. But he that is least in the kingdom of God is greater than he. And all the people that heard him, and the publicans, justified God, being baptized with the baptism of John. But the Pharisees and lawyers rejected the counsel of God against themselves, being not baptized of him. And the Lord said, Whereunto then shall I liken the men of this generation? And to what are they like? They are like unto children sitting in the marketplace, and calling one to another, and saying, We have piped unto you, and ye have not danced. We have mourned to you, and ye have not wept. For John the Baptist came neither eating bread nor drinking wine, and ye say, He hath a devil. The Son of Man has come eating and drinking, and ye say, Behold, a gluttonous man and a winebibber, a friend of publicans and sinners. But wisdom is justified of all her children. And one of the Pharisees desired him that he would eat with him. And he went into the Pharisee's house, and sat down to meat. And behold, a woman in the city, which was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at meat in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster box of ointment, and stood at his feet behind him, weeping, and began to wash his feet with tears, and did wipe them with the hairs of her head, and kissed his feet, and anointed them with the ointment. Now when the Pharisee which had bidden him saw it, he spake within himself, saying, This man, if he were a prophet, would have known who and what manner of woman this is that toucheth him, for she is a sinner. And Jesus answering said unto him, Simon, I have somewhat to say unto thee. And he saith, Master, say on. There was a certain creditor which had two debtors. The one owed 500 pence, and the other 50. And when they had nothing to pay, he frankly forgave them both. Tell me, therefore, which of them will love him most? Simon answered and said, I suppose that he to whom he forgave most. And he said unto him, Thou hast rightly judged. And he turned to the woman and said unto Simon, Seest thou this woman? I entered into thine house. Thou gavest me no water for my feet, but she hath washed my feet with tears, and wiped them with the hairs of her head. Thou gavest me no kiss, but this woman since the time I came in hath not ceased to kiss my feet. My head with oil thou didst not anoint, but this woman hath anointed my feet with ointment. Wherefore I say unto thee, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But to whom little is forgiven, the same loveth little. And he said unto her, Thy sins are forgiven. And they that sat at meat with him began to say within themselves, Who is this that forgiveth sins also? And he said to the woman, Thy faith hath saved thee. Go in peace.
Okay. All right, Jen, do we have any questions tonight?
Yes, we have a couple, three here, John.
Okay.
The first is to get around Posse Comitatus. Act of 1878, is the government now materializing the local police?
Is the government material? I don't understand that. Do you understand?
Well, are they creating their own posse out of the local police?
I presume they're talking about that in order to collect all of these illegals, and local police, at least in Florida and I guess certain other states, are starting to work with the federal government. Is that maybe what this person is talking about?
I'm not sure, John.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe that's probably it. And that's not necessarily Posse Comitatus at all. It's just a matter of getting out and enforcing the law within the cities and the towns and villages and so on within the various states, and to, of course, turn them over to, the feds, and in order for them to be sent back home. And so that's the only thing I could think of that they might be talking about. So if not, maybe they'll come in and ask more specifically, maybe next week or unless they're here tonight. Okay, next question.
Now, this is a long one. And so I'll read it carefully. I've read your common law handbook for jurors, sheriffs, bailiffs, and justices, and I am today on Chapter 5 of Government by Consent. I must admit to being blown away by the truths I'm reading about and angry that I was never taught this in junior high school or college. Nevertheless, I now have this burning question as a result of my military intelligence background, especially in view of the Military Justice Act of 2016. I have also read Derek Johnson's new books, Volume 1 and 2, of the Might Knight Rider Rides again, and I pair my civilian law knowledge with my military law knowledge. As you may know, our Army, Navy, and Marines were created a year before the Declaration of Independence in 1775, so our military comes first in our country. We couldn't have declared our independence without our military in the Revolutionary War. Military law was also created in 1775. While it is widely known that the U.S. Constitution is the supreme law of the land, I think that such is not completely accurate. The Constitution should be known as the supreme civilian law of the land. I believe that the Supreme Court and all civilian laws are inferior to all military courts and all military laws. I'm very curious as to your response to my long-held belief about this.
All right. Well, you know, during that time period that you were talking about, you know, it was the Continental Congress that came together in order to try to deal with the problems. And so the first time around, you know, they didn't really accomplish much. But the second time around, of course, they came up with the Declaration of Independence, which was finally completed in approximately July 4th, 1776. I don't remember the exact date, but for some reason we do have the 4th as written down, and I guess I think what it was is not all the signatures were on at that time, but in any event, that is what took place. But meanwhile, of course, we were preparing for war because we were separating ourselves, and the Continental Congress came together, of course, to deal with that problem. And during the time period of the Revolutionary War, there were 10 presidents, and the Continental Congress elected those 10 presidents one after another. Every year they elected another president, I believe. And so there was a total of 10. And so they had a process, and of course the military, they had to have military law, so of course they created what they created and in order to control the military. And again, they put the president, of course, in charge of the military, which again was elected by the Continental Congress. When the Constitution was finally came together and they pretty much came to a completion around 1787, but then of course the Anti-Federalist Papers, what we're calling them, you know, came to be or was in process, and the big concern was that they felt that there wasn't enough restrictions to control the government and particularly to protect us from our rights. And they agreed upon 12 Bill of Rights, which was brought to 10, but there's a couple in each one. Everything that they asked for and agreed upon and debated, it was agreed upon. And in 1791, the Bill of Rights became part of the Constitution. And so we have the Declaration of Independence of 1776, which is the foundation of our law. We're under natural law. And, of course, we have the Constitution itself, which lays out the powers and powers and the authorities that we gave, that we invested the three branches of government with. Of course, in first article in Section 8, we laid out the powers and the authorities for the legislators to write law, and in that process they did write law. The Constitution at that point in time laid out the president was the chief chief authority over the military. So the president was the authority before, during the Continental Congress, and then of course once the Constitution came into play, that also was the case. Now, I suspect that during the process of going through the the anti-federalist papers, those conversations took place at that point. And I suspect that there was a lot of legislation that was being brought together and probably came into play early on, so that as soon as the Constitution became effective in 1789, I think they probably did have some legislation. And I would imagine that a lot of the legislation would be under control also, of course, of the military. And so legislation was written for the military. So, first of all, the president, of course, is commander-in-chief of the military. And the legislators wrote the necessary controls, laws, which would be statutes and codes and regulations for the military. And I'm looking to see where that would be in which particular U.S. code. Let's see, we have armed forces is USC Title 10, we have the National Guard, USC Title 32. We have the Navy under 34, and of course later on we have. Let's see, this should be the Air Force in here. But anyway, those are the legislation that was written in order to control, that gave the power and the authority what their powers and what their authorities were as far as defending this nation. And again, the Commander-in-Chief being the President of the United States. So they've never been on their own. Military law is a necessity in order to control the military, to have their regulations and so on. It is different from the law that we're under, which is common law, natural law, the laws of nature and of nature's God. Again, we read about that in the Declaration of Independence, and it is codified in the Constitution where it is said that we are under law and equity. Equity is legislative law, and of course, the military law is equity. Even the president is controlled by legislation. Even Congress is controlled by legislation. U.S. Title II controls the Congress. U.S.C. Title III controls the president. Okay. And of course, there's many, many others. 57 U.S.C. titles altogether, and they're all, appropriate, and I think they're pretty well done. Of course, we do have some problems because they put us under civil law, and they tried to tie us on the federal level under USC 18, which talks about crimes and procedures that has nothing to do with we the people. And it should only have things to do with the individuals that fall underneath the U.S. titles. Okay. Also, of course, they put in here 26 was totally repugnant to the Constitution, which is the Internal Revenue Code. That doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, anybody that thinks that they can read and get anything out of that, I've looked at a lot of stuff in there, and it's just nothing but garbage. I mean, nothing makes any sense. Although they do have some things in there that really help us to lay out who is liable, okay? And we are not liable. People are not liable. So, the law, of course, again, puts us under equity, and it puts us under law. Equity, again, is for those people who are working for government agencies, or they are working in some commercial activities, usually interstate and the federal level, and other commercial activities within the state. They control things within the state. So the states, of course, have followed suit in a lot of this stuff. So Article 3 brings us to the judicial powers, which we just spoke about, shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution. So that's the key. Now, laws, the word law means common law, natural law. It always did. Even in Black's Law, Blackstone's, Black's Law, Bouvier's Law, all of them identify law as that which proceeds according to the common law. Okay, and equity, of course, again, gets back to legislative powers and authorities, and we gave them, our legislators, certain powers and authorities, And nothing can violate our unalienable rights. Of course, a lot of this stuff does from time to time, especially in USC 18, USC 28, and USC 26, because, again, they kind of mix things together. As a matter of fact, of course, that's what our paper is all about, for our redress of grievances, which I have posted up here. This is the final paper for anybody who would like to go read it. We did read this out, I think it was last week or the week before. I don't remember when. I think it was 2 weeks ago. But anyway, we read this out. I've made some changes, I made some corrections, and, you know, and put this together. So, again, everybody should read this. These papers will be going out this week. I'm working on all that right now. We've bought all the books, we've got all the packaging, we've got the toner, we've got the papers to print. Working now on the mailing will be the final cost on this. We're going to file this without paying $300, which is what the Supreme Court usually wants. But we're coming from a perspective of a presentment. And I'm just going to read the front page or the main points of this here. This is an extraordinary presentment to the Supreme Court of the United States. The Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury, the Sureties of Peace, against the federal judiciary. And this is an original jurisdiction for the United States Supreme Court. And common law, this is a common law court of record, for a redress of grievances brief for we the people and unalienable rights secured by Amendment 1. And then we go into this extraordinary presentment. And it follows a certain protocol. This is the protocol that I've discovered in my research and studying, that these type of things, these are the basic things that have to be covered. You know, you have to have a cover page. You have to have some basic overview of what you're coming in to talk about, which I put down as the extraordinary presentment. And then the statement of the case, again, which gives more detail of the case, table of contents, table of authorities, and then the brief. Okay, so all of these things are required, or this is a regular protocol that is used in order to file the papers with the Supreme Court. And so we're following their protocol. But we're coming in from the perspective of the grand jury with a presentment concerning, subversion at the highest level. And of course, the paper is all about overtly taking common law and abrogated it, and they fused law and equity together, and they call it civil law. Someone's got an open mic here. Jan, maybe you. They fused equity with law together, and then they called it civil law. And that's what this paper talks about. So people, if they're not familiar with this, or they just have a little bit of familiarity with the Rules Enabling Act of 1934, you should read this paper and you'll be brought up to par exactly what's going on and how they destroyed our Constitution. Totally destroyed our Constitution, destroyed the law of the land, destroyed the Declaration of Independence, just destroyed it all. And they gave us civil rights. They've taken away our unalienable rights and given us civil rights. And this is what we're up against, and this is what we're fighting. So anyway, that's where we're at with that. Okay, back to the questions now. Anything else there, Jan?
John, quick note, if you please.
Questions tonight.
The military is far, and I've brought this up before, but the military is always to be subject to the civil authority. Always. Let me make that clear.
Correct.
Okay, yeah. So he has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. This is the 12th, as I count them, grievance in the Declaration of Independence. I'm looking for the quote also in the ratification debates. I can't find it, but it basically says the same thing. The military is always, at all times, to be subject to the civil authority. It doesn't come first. This Derrick Johnson idea is incorrect. It's absolutely incorrect.
Absolutely. Yes, yeah. And that is the point of the president being in charge and overcharged commander-in-chief, both during the Revolutionary War, where we had 10 presidents, which were under the control of the Continental Congress, which was, you know, individuals from each of the colonies, or 13 colonies, in order to fight this war and run some kind of a government during that time period. And as time got closer, of course, they had the debates, which is the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers, and then, of course, they came up with the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. So, yeah, you're absolutely right, and I guess that I should have made that point a little clear. Military is always under civil control, as far in America, as far as being under usually the control of the president.
Hey, here it is, right here. Excellent, good point. I'm glad you stated it a little more strongly. Also, when I did a little presentation on communities of safety here in Georgia for a Constitution class, and I referenced something that you had pointed out, that in 1692, okay, long before 1775, all right, long before, the militia was acting, and you brought this point up, and you made it clear that the militia took a perspective of objectivity for a moment and said, hey, wait a minute. We're doing this wrong. We need to be subject to the civil authority. Therefore, we must create a committee of safety that we will be under. This I got from one of your papers. 1692. Here is the quote in the Virginia ratification debates. 17th, that the people have a right to keep and bear arms, that a well-regulated militia composed of the body of the people trained to arms is the proper, natural, and safe defense of a free state, that standing armies in time of peace are dangerous to liberty and therefore ought to be avoided as far as the circumstances and protection of the community will admit, and that, in all cases, the military should be under strict subordination to and governed by the civil power. This is from the ratification debates. These are the terms and legal definitions, the legal terms and legal definitions of what the Constitution means. Just wanted to make that point, and I yield.
Yeah, and the military never took the pinnacle power. It never had, never will.
Amen.
As long as we continue under the Constitution. Okay, I think that answers the question. Anything else, Jen?
Yeah, there's no more questions, John. That's all I had.
That's all you got. Okay. Anyway, I spoke with someone who comes onto the call often, of course, probably on tonight now, and he's been supporting us for quite some time, especially when we need some money. And of course, we're always in need of money, and particularly for this thing we're going through right now, sending the papers to the United States Supreme Court, putting them on notice through a presentment by the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury. And anyway, he's putting up $1,000, and he would like to have that matched. So hopefully people will give a few dollars here or there, whatever you can afford, $5, $10, $20, $50, and hopefully we'll be able to match that $1,000. So anyway, I just wanted to make that announcement on that. So whatever you can do, we'd appreciate that donation. And again, it's going for a good cause. We'll finish paying off, of course, whatever thing we have necessary left to finish on this case. And we've got 50 books going out altogether. I think it's 50. Let me think. 45, 47. Yeah, I think it's about 50. Maybe it's 49. 49 or 50 books. I'll say 50. 50 books going out, government by consent, to everyone who's going to Trump, of course, and to everyone in his administration and certain individuals around him and certain senators and congressmen. With that, we're sending a copy, of course, of this press presentment that we're sending to the Supreme Court, and also a 3-page cover sheet, cover letter, introducing and talking particularly about what we're doing here. So that'll all be going out this week. I'm working through that right now. So by next Monday, we will have the announcement that it went out, and the Supreme Court should have it, and the book should be going out. Also looking to send a couple of books out to other people, particularly Joe Rogan. He's got a lot of following. He talks about, the law from time to time. It's definitely about our government and different things taking place. And I think if we send him a copy of the book, Government by Consent, I do believe he'll probably look at it. He's He's a very curious individual, and I think he's got a photographic memory. I mean, the guy comes up with all this memorizing all these people he talked to over the years. And we'll also send him a copy of the paper, and maybe we'll get interviewed by him. If we were to get interviewed by Rogan, he's got millions, literally, in plural, millions of followers. I mean, if we can get interviewed by Rogan, we would really, it would blow this whole thing up as far as hitting, critical mass. Also, Tucker Carlson. I'm thinking of sending him a book. I was looking for his address. I haven't been able to find Tucker Carlson's address. I've looked everywhere, a few places where I thought it might be, but it's not clear. And so maybe others could be out there, can look around and see if they can't find Tucker's address. I'd like to get him a copy of the book, and the paper that we're sending to the United States Supreme Court. And again, he has, I think, 1.1 million followers. So, again, he's got a lot of people following, and if we can get onto his program, maybe he'll interview us. And I would imagine both of them would be very interested in what we're doing if they come to understanding what we're doing. So if anybody can go out there and see if they can't find Tucker Carlson's mailing address, we got email addresses and different contacts for different purposes, but nothing directly to Rogan. Carlson, Tucker Carlson. All right, so hopefully people will help us, and hopefully people will help us to match that $1,000, collectively speaking. So, let me see what else you might want to talk about before we consider. By the way, the queue is open. Anybody has... Wants to get into the queue, it's *6-1 if you're on a telephone. If you're on an app or browser, there is a button to enter into the queue, and we'll take it from there. In a couple of weeks, I'm not sure when, I spoke with an individual, and he's connected to a large group of individuals across America or throughout the states. Or at least a certain section of the states, I think mostly out west. And I think he said he's got like 45 or so individuals that are interested in doing things and want to get an education. So I'm trying to convince them that they should come work with us, create committees of safety. We're hands off. We're just facilitating a place in order for people to come together, communicate, and organize their committees of safety and to help educate them and advise them with any questions that they might have. But they're free and independent to do as they please, but we do hopefully ask that they follow the protocol that we set up. It's extremely important that the committees of safety follow the protocol. And as far as how to deal with the problems, it's all up to you. We can share some ideas. We can try to get to different other individuals to share ideas that they're doing that might work, whatever the specific problem might be. But it's important to come together with a proper structure so that we can work together from county to county and across state to state, to all the counties across the United States. So when we're dealing, all politics is local. Not that we get involved with the politics. We get involved with the political process. We need to get rid of parties. It's extremely important that we get rid of parties. Party is the destruction. Between the bar attorneys and the parties, the political parties, those are the two destructive things that have destroyed us, when you go to the bar has really had their fingers in everything. Nothing goes into law without going through the bar attorneys. No one goes as far as legislation is concerned. Many of our representatives that do legislation on the federal level, and then probably the same as on the state level, are lawyers. They're bar attorneys, and they believe in civil law. They believe that we are under Roman law. They believe that this nation was created under Rome, that was structured like Rome was. Nothing could be further from the truth. Okay, we're not under Roman law. We're under common law, which comes from ultimately the first common law nation was Israel in about 1600 BC. And so we're under and we copied our nation has been copied under Israel. So this is hard for esquires, you know, these people with that were trained by the bar. It's hard for them to receive that because they've been taught something different, and we're just crazies. But in any event, we're trying to get the word out to wake people up and to make a change. We have to, you know, resurrect the original 13th Amendment, which would require, because look at all judges, and maybe there's an exception here or there, but it'd be very rare and far and in between. All judges are bar attorneys, every single judge, and they're chosen by the bar. You're not going to become a judge unless the bar anoints you, okay? And that's true also to go up and make a case with the Supreme Court. You know, you got to be a bar member. You know, they set the whole thing up. They control the law. They have been writing all the law. Who do you think wrote the Rules Enabling Act of 1934? Who do you think wrote actually the rules for the United States Supreme Court in 1948? That was all bar attorneys that did all that. They've totally destroyed our nation. They've taken control of everything. And then they've set the stage for the political process to give us party bosses through statutory processes. And so we've lost our political process. We've lost our judicial process. We've lost our courts of law. We've lost our Constitution. We've lost our Bill of Rights. It's time to take it back. And so that's what we're doing here, of course. And we need to make this clear with Trump and his administration and hopefully get some kind of a relationship with them out of this to really get involved. We would like to, you know, I spoke with Brent Alan Winters a while back concerning this idea of writing textbooks for children, K through 12, and he agreed that we'd do that, and I'm sure we can find another author or two that is working in the law or the common law or the history, American history. But if not, I think between the two of us, we can do some really good work and pretty much take our books and, you know, make them appropriate for the certain age groups, you know, from K through 12. Also, I thought about contacting NCCS, which is the people who put out these constitutional handbooks, they have a lot of books. They have books like, for instance, The Real Thomas Jefferson, The Real Benjamin Franklin, The Real George Washington. And these books are collected information that documents who they are and what they've said because it's on conversations in their days and different things, maybe letters between, our founding fathers, the work that they've done. So all of this is all, of course, all documented. I've got all three books, and it's just it blows my mind. So those three books are, you know, really good books, and I think we can convince them to turn those into textbooks. And if they don't feel that they have someone that could do that, we'll suggest we'll do it for them. We're not looking to make money on their books. We're just looking to get their books that as curriculum into the schools. So they got a lot of books. The Making of America, a really great history book.
Hey, John, that I think I might have brought this up once before, too, but The Making of America, I heard a fella in California speaking of it. He was an educator. He said they were going to have that as a textbook, so I don't think it's foreign to them. In California, but the filthy, stinking, pharisaical media got to him, and they caused an uproar. They stirred up the people, just like in the Book of Acts, left, right, and center, and they stopped it from happening. But anyway, it's not a foreign idea to them.
They do have some textbooks already on some things, and it may be on the Making of America. I don't remember, but I have to look into it. It's been a while since I looked into it. But they did put some stuff together maybe for homeschoolers, maybe for curriculum in private schools that would accept it. One of the things I want to do, though, is I want to try to connect with Trump or his administration particularly and talk with him about, not necessarily with him directly, but with somebody we'd like to get connected to there, if we can, to talk about the need for a proper education, you know, not just civics, but, you know, real, you know, history and getting into the Constitution, the Federalist Papers, the Anti-Federalist Papers, and all the conversations between our founding fathers, you know, to bring all this together so that when, by the time the children get out of school, they're fully informed on law, on how due process works, how the court system works, how the processes work. They should be able to get up and take care of their own legal business instead of giving all their money to lawyers that don't represent them. They represent themselves. It's all about money, and they also they will fulfill the requirements and the desire of the judge before a lawyer takes care of the people that he's writing or working for that's paying the bill. So, but yeah, I think it's going to be pretty simple for them to come on board with this. And again, if they need our assistance in turning this into textbooks, I mean, it's just a matter of taking the books, breaking it up, and really putting questions behind the chapters. And because I tell you what. People need to know Thomas Jefferson. He's one of the most important individuals in my mind. America would not be here without Thomas Jefferson. You could also say America may not be here without George Washington, because he did what he had to do to keep this nation going and to keep it together even after the war. And Benjamin Franklin, who was the instigator of this whole thing. You know, and he was around in 1750 causing problems and chaos for the king. And that's why in 1750, the king sent armies, swarms of bar attorneys in order to destroy our judicial system. We were under common law then. And they did a very good job in destroying it, especially in a lot of places where... judges act as if they are the final word of everything. And bear in mind, you know, these judges that make these decisions, they are administrative law judges. They're dealing with administrations. They have nothing to do with we the people, yet they make all these decisions. And especially in the town level, they put people in jail without jury, without an indictment, without due process, outside of the realms of the common law, and judges will overturn juries. Judges will say, well, we've got a jury that can't finalize their decision, so, we'll just throw it away and we'll start all over, or whatever the case may be. I've even seen and heard of cases where the judges changed what the jury's decisions were. Again, it's a mess, and we need to fix it. But it first starts with education. And unfortunately, I'm convinced of this. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'm convinced of this, that Trump and his administrations do not understand the common law. They do not really know the true history of America. I may be wrong in this, but I don't think I am. They're getting little tidbits here or there. When they call us a democracy, okay, that tells me everything, that they're ignorant to certain things. They're ignorant to who we are as a people. And even some of them will call us a democratic republic, and that's an oxymoron. That just doesn't work. No republic, no true republic. There's a couple of hundred republics in the world, but we're the only natural law republic, the only one. And so, they don't understand this. And there's no way a natural law republic can survive parties. They just can't survive it. Washington told us about this long before these parties rose, and they were having problems already, people trying to develop parties, and they call it fractionalism, I believe it's called. In any event, Washington spoke very specific about this in his farewell address. And I would say at least two-thirds of it was about political parties and the problems it would cause and the destruction of this nation should we continue that road. And we did continue that road. And they got away, they took the committee man process, they took it, they statutorized it, brought it under the control of party bosses, and they've been in control of that for many, many years. You know, going back, goodness, 150, maybe 160, maybe even longer than that. And Jefferson's position, of course, was that the judges were going to destroy this nation. They both were right, okay? So education is the only thing that's going to really solve this problem. You know, giving our children a proper education for the future is the only way we'll keep this nation. And we must get rid of political parties. We must get rid of these esquires, the minions of the New World Order, that's the bar attorneys, okay? They have this position or this title of honor, okay? And that title of honor is an esquire. And the 13th Amendment is clear that anybody who takes this process and goes on ceases to be a citizen of the United States and can never hold an office of trust. That's what the original 13th Amendment said. And that 13th Amendment was, let's see, I think it was 1818. It was just a little after the 1800s. So our founding fathers were still in power in the sense of participating and giving a lot of influence to the government, and some of them, of course, still were inside government by 1818, and so again, we need to go back to what our founders originally paid a very high price for to give us what we have today. So, anyway. That's the main focus here of National Liberty Alliance, although we're doing a lot of other things. Of course, we're building the committees of safety, we're doing administrators for the juries, trying to get back to the courts of law, not only on the federal level, but on every state level. And this is government, you know, but by consent, and it's... the only way we can control this country is through committees of safety, people getting involved on the local level, and making the decisions. And look at when they don't do the right thing, we're going to teach people how to recall them. You can pull them out of office and get another election within 90 days on a recall. So, okay, with that, I guess we're going to open the queue. Let's see, we should have, let's see how many people are in the queue at the moment. Okay, we've got two people in the queue. Anybody wants to get into the queue, *6 and 1 if you're on a phone. And if you're on an Apple browser, there'll be a button there. Hey, Gerard, you want to pick up things for a while? Gerard, you with us? You're muted.
When do I, worry about
just
it?
Just give me a few minutes. I got my daughter on the phone. Her son is sick. I just need to confer with her for a minute before I come on.
Okay, I'll start anyway. All right, again, if anybody wants to get into the queue, we only got two people in the queue. So pop on in. Any questions, comments, corrections, or anything to offer us. We'll take our first caller. It's a 702 number. What's your first name and your state? First name and state. You've just been unmuted. 702 area code. .886 number. You got the mic. .702-886. Just calling once, twice. I don't know if you're trying to talk, but we're not hearing you. You are muted from our end now. All right, we'll go to another call. If you're trying to get your mic fixed, you can get back into the queue. Ross, let's take Ross. Hang on a second. Well, I just heard something on 702. You there? Right. Ross, you got the mic. Go right ahead.
You hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay. I did ask a question to AI about after we saw the original citizenship before the Civil War, and it mentioned, establish a community of safety.
They mentioned what?
The community of safety.
Okay.
That's the only way we can restore the original citizenship. The original citizenship is state citizenship.
Well, the original, look at this. Citizenship, in a state gives you citizenship ultimately in every state, really. I mean, you could just pick up your bags and your belongings and just go across the line and you're immediately a citizen of that state that you're in. And we gave the authority to grant people citizenship through process on a federal level. So the federal government does have the power and the authority to grant citizenship to individuals. But that doesn't make them a federal citizen. It makes them a citizen of the United States, little u, United States, and not a federal level, but whatever state they want to live in. And again, all the rights and let me see if I can find this real quick. I'll read it in the Constitution here. If it's 9 here, is it 9 or 10? Pretty sure it's 9. Wait a second. I think it's an article. It's a different article. I think it's Article 4 or 5. Yeah, 4. 4. Section 1. Full faith and credit shall be given in each state to the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of every other state. So you can go to any state you want and exercise any right you want as a citizen in that state. And it doesn't matter that you may live in a different state. If you're in that state and you're executing the judicial process in that state, that's it. You're a citizen of that state at that moment in time, at least for the time you're there. So again, we're citizens of all the states ultimately. So, but people get confused on that. And they think they have to become a nationalist, or they have to do something, they have to get rid of their citizenship. And the last thing you want to do is try to do that, because then you're not a citizen of the United States. They can kick you out of the country, so that could be a problem. But there's no need for that. We just need to take the processes back. That's what we need to do. So.
Virginia.
What was that about Virginia?
The founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, was loyal to the state of Virginia.
Right.
And their citizenship was just Virginia, not entire. They didn't care about your citizenship exactly.
Well, that was before the Constitution, and that's when they were colonies, and they were, to some degree, in a sense, they were isolated from each other. In other words, they were all on their own authority, doing their own thing, even though they were under British rule, and British rule didn't do much for them, and a lot of laws and different things, so they created their own laws and ran their own, whatever Britain did not provide for the colonies, for the purpose of acting as, some kind of an authority, and it's almost like a state. They were colonies, and they provided for themselves through the Committees of Safety. And that's what the Committees of Safety, of course, in all 13 colonies came together to form the Continental Congress and to go forward to ultimately, disengage ourselves from Britain and become the United States of America. Then they became states. So at that time, I guess Jefferson would have been a citizen of Virginia alone, But they did have certain appreciations for each other within the colonies. They worked together all the time.
Yes. It means people think we were not. I asked my uncle one time, that he said, oh, we will never get rid of political parties.
Yeah, a lot of people think we can't get rid of political parties. Our founding fathers said we won't survive with political parties, so I think we have to take their advice, at least start off there and start looking at this thing. And, you know, so the problems, again, all these problems come from the political parties. It's one end, you know, one side against the other constantly, and it's just moving us closer and closer to destruction, closer and closer to less rights and violating our rights more and more. But let me see if I can find this here. I wrote a three-page letter. I think I read this paper before, but I think I read it when it was two pages. And, you know, I tried to keep it short, but, you know, there's so much really that needs to be spoken in order to get the point across. And this is the letter, the cover letter, that we sent to Trump and all the people in his administration and many, many others. So let me take a quick look at that. Do you have another question while I'm looking for this, Ross? Anything else you wanted to add to what you were saying? Okay, and by the way, there's nobody else in the queue. If anybody wants to get into the queue, it's a *6 and 1 if you're on a phone, and if you're on an Apple browser, should be a button. Okay, I'm just going to read a little bit of this since we have nobody else in the queue. Do you have anything else, Ross?
No.
Okay. All right, while we wait for people to get into the queue, I'll read a little bit of this because I think it really, really helps us to explain the problems here and concerning the fact that we cannot survive a political party, okay? So, we have been taught, and this is how the letter starts, to President Trump and his cabinet and others. And by the way, we do list out all of the people that we copied. Let me just go back to that real quick. I didn't have this in the paper last time. These are all the people we copying on this paper that was sent to the, that was sending to the United States Supreme Court. So again, it's all of Trump's, all of his administration, and then some senators and congressmen and a few other individuals. So, okay. So to President Trump, cabinet, and others, we have all been taught the lie. It ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so. Mark Twain. Our founding fathers reviled democracy and gave their posterity a republic. As Thomas Jefferson said, the republican is the only form of government which is not eternally at open or secret war with the rights of mankind. Sounds familiar, huh? We the people chose a republican form of government, not a democratic republican form of government. The phrase democratic republican is an oxymoron. We the people ordained Article 4, Section 4, the United States shall guarantee to every state of this union a republican form of government and separate each of them against invasion. Ross, are you saying something?
No, I can mute my thing for you.
You what?
I said,
I got to
mute myself.
All right. Let me continue on this then. We the people chose a Republican form of government, not a Democratic Republican form of government. Okay, I just read that to guarantee us a Republican form of government and protect us against invasion. While trying to discover a form of government, John Adams wrote, "Democracies never last long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and it murders itself. There was never a democracy that did not commit suicide. We stand at that precipice today." In Federalist No. 10, Madison wrote, "Democracies have ever been spectacles of turbulence and contention, have ever been found incompatible with personal security or rights of property, and have in general been as short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths." In Anti-Federalist No. 10, we read, "True Democrats are in general fanatics and enthusiasts, and some few sensible, charming madmen." Sounds familiar, huh? Anti-Federalist number 74, we read, "There is not a tincture of democracy in the proposed Constitution. Every free man of America ought to hold up this idea to himself, that he has no superior but God and the laws. Just because we elect most of our representatives by popular vote does not make us a democracy. We don't elect the president by popular vote, and we should not be electing our senators at all. The 17th Amendment destroyed the balance of power and is repugnant to the Constitution. See Article 5. The states lost suffrage and thereby lost their sovereignty. And the people, and that's eclipse sovereignty. I should have put the word eclipse sovereignty there. And the people lost their representatives to special interest groups and thereby lost their sovereignty. And we lost our common law courts by the Rules Enabling Act, which abrogated our Bill of Rights. Read the enclosed grand jury filing for redress of grievances to the U.S. Supreme Court. Whereas we do not take back our courts of justice, we will no more be the land of the free. One method of assault may be to effect in the form of the Constitution alterations which will impair the system to undermine what cannot be directly overthrown." George Washington's farewell address. "All obstructions to the execution of the laws, all combinations and associations, political parties, under whatever plausible character, with the real design to direct, control, counteract, or the regular deliberation and action of the constituted authorities, are destructive of this fundamental principle and a fatal tendency. They serve to organize faction." Again, factions are the parties that are being created at that point in time, you know, groups, which is an exclusive circle of people with a common purpose, "to give it an artificial and extraordinary force, to put into place of the delegated will of the nation the will of a party. Often a small but artful and enterprising minority of the community, and according to the alternate triumphs of different parties, to make the public administration the mirror of the ill-concerted and incongruous projects of faction, rather than the organ of consistent and wholesome plans digested by common councils and modified by mutual interest. However, combinations of associations of the above description," that's the Democrat and Republican parties, "may now and then answer popular ends. They are likely," and by the way, the first political party was the Federalists. The Federalists was the first political party. Well, a group of people grabbed hold of the ideals of the Federalists and created a party out of that. So, anyway, "the above description may now and then answer popular ends. They are likely in the course of time and things to become potent engines by which cunning, ambitious, and unprincipled men will be enabled to subvert the power of the people and to usurp for themselves the reins of government." That has happened. "Destroying afterwards the very engines which have lifted them up to unjust dominions." And by the way, the main engine that lifted them up was the committeeman process. They statutorized it, put in party bosses, and taken control of everything. "One method of assault may be to effect in the forms of the Constitution alterations which will impair the energy of the system and thus to undermine what cannot be directly overthrown. It is indeed little else than a name where the government is too feeble to withstand the enterprises of faction, and that's where we're at. We've come to that precipice. To confine each member of the society within the limits prescribed by the laws, and to maintain all in the secure and tranquil enjoyment of the rights of the people and property. It opens the door to foreign influences and corruption, which find a facilitated access to the government itself through the channels of party passions. Thus, the policy and the will of one country are subject to the policy and will of another. Again, sound familiar? Right, I see I got someone else in the queue. We'll be with you in a minute. Anybody else wants to get into the queue? Star 6 and 1 if you're on a phone, and if you're on an app or browser, it should be a button. Regrettably, the aforesaid clause was covertly removed between 1909. Well, let me go back. I guess I didn't read this part. Okay, Our founding fathers were generally uneasy about political parties. For the most part, they believed that parties had the potential to tear the new nation apart. To these men, political parties meant factionalism, which they believed could be fatal to the development of the United States as a unified country. It is no surprise, then, that political parties are entirely omitted from the U.S. Constitution. In response to George Washington's concern on parties, the following clause was written into the New York election law, section 21, which stated, "No organization or association of citizens for the election of the city or town offices shall be deemed a political party." That's the committee man that they've statutorized and made them into political parties. They broke them apart. You got the Republicans, you got the Democrats, and then you got a bunch of other different parties. They may be minor, but nevertheless, it just divides the people. Okay, we're not on one accord. We should all be constitutionalists is what we should be. Regrettably, the aforesaid clause was covertly removed between 1909 and 1911 and thereby codified party bosses' control over party committeemen through self-serving rules. And today, John Adams' dreaded political evil came to pass and the two-party system reached maturity, fulfilling George Washington's warnings and thereby ushered in the beginning of the end of our republic via party bosses in the Republican Party Association and the Democrat Party Association. All of America's woes can be traced back to political parties. George Washington was right, but for some strange, illogical reason, many people believe that a Republican form of government cannot work without a two-party system, where we'd actually get business done if we didn't have a two-party system, because they wouldn't be collecting themselves, you know, these are on the right and these are on the left, and you don't get anything done. Okay, so he was right, and for some strange reason, illogical reason, many people believe that a Republican form of government cannot work without a two-party system, whereas our founding fathers didn't think so. And in fact, they said the opposite is true, as President George Washington clearly articulated above. If there were no party-controlled agendas that serve special interest groups, which is nothing short of unlawful bribes for favor, the will of the people would be served. Whereas if there were no party bosses orchestrating personal agendas that they have no business debating, then they would actually be free to represent their constituents, which is what they were elected to do. Therefore, in order to have a true republic, which is ruled by law, that we, the people, ordained and established, we must nullify political parties and unlawful special interest groups. We, the people, detailed congressional powers under Article 1, Section 8. They have no business debating our unalienable rights or any issue that we, the people, did not vest them with. If we don't reestablish our political and judicial processes back to what our founding fathers pledged, their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to secure, America will not survive. Considering the implosion of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party's rallying around the Constitution, we have a window of opportunity to return to our roots. As Jefferson said when he was elected president, "We were all Federalists. We were all Republicans." His statement was an attempt to end growing factions and encourage a rallying around the newly adopted Constitution. Labels are divisive. Therefore, if we find it necessary to have a label, It should be, we are all constitutionalists. Let's end political parties and special interest groups, group bribes, and resurrect the Constitution. The people want a solution to our problem, whereas our common law founding documents is that solution. We will never have this chance again. All the work that President Trump and his administration are doing is worthless if we don't listen to Jefferson and Washington, because our liberty rests in our common law, without which there can be no liberty. It will only be a matter of time when psychopaths and sociopaths regain power again and bring us back to the brink of destruction. The judiciary's dark reason for covertly and criminally abolishing common law is because they claim that a rigid application of common law rules, also known as God's laws written in the hearts of men, built upon self-evident truths, maxims brought about injustice. This is absurd, considering that God is good, just, and merciful, and they are not. And therefore it follows that his laws is just and merciful, while the hearts of men are desperately wicked. Who could know it? As we read in Jeremiah 17:7-9, blessed is the man that trusteth in Jehovah, and whose hope the Jehovah is. For he shall be as a tree planted by the water, and that spreadeth out her roots by the river, and shall not see when heat cometh. But her leaf shall be green, and shall not be careful in the year of drought, neither shall cease from yielding fruits. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who could know it? So the truth of the matter is that common law sheds light on the judiciary's dark deeds, thereby revealing their true intentions. Their claim that common law rules brought about injustice was an act of deflection, whereas their civil law rules brought about injustice. A silent coup by claiming the abrogation of common law with its unalienable rights that were endowed by our Creator and covertly substituted them with civil rights legislated by lawless men. Sociopaths and psychopaths always deflect upon us what they are guilty of. Let's listen to our founding fathers and restore America to the republic that they paid dearly for. Okay, and then of course, this is the cover letter to all of books and the Supreme Court papers were sending out. And so the attachment, we've got attachments here, which was redress of grievances to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the book, Government by Consent, which should be required in all schools receiving federal funding. Our children need to know the blessings that no other people enjoy and their duty to preserve it through county committees of safety. Only then can we have government by consent. NLA is committed to this goal. Okay. Anyway, that paper, I don't think I have that up there online. So what I'll do, again, I put the paper to the Supreme Court here, and I think I'll put the letter underneath it. I'll try to do that tomorrow so people can read that again if they want. And you should reread the redress of grievances because I have added to it and a lot of changes in it, and I think it's pretty powerful. So with that, we're going to go back to the queue. Gerard, you want to pick up the queue? Let me push the button.
I wanted to say make a couple comments before we get going.
Yeah, go ahead.
Two things. We've studied some of Derek Johnson's work. You know, he's a military aficionado, kind of somewhat of an expert he's become. What's his stance on the military being subservient to the civil authority?
I don't think he makes a statement like that. It's just the individual had a, you know, it's something he felt and believed all his life, and I was wondering what our position or thinking was on that, but I don't think really had that same position.
You think he thinks that the military is unto itself in those places and not subservient to the people?
Well, that it has a higher power somehow, I think, is what... is that how you read it, Jan? That it had a higher power, maybe?
Maybe when we're under martial law or something, but that can't be the norm.
Well, even then it wouldn't be, because it still has to be under the power and the authority of the president, which is a civilian.
Right.
We elected him for that purpose. And so, that's more.
If he understands that the president is a... I think I've heard him say that You have to have that civilian authority in there, and the president is a civilian.
Even though
he's a commander-in-chief, he's still a civilian.
Right, and he's the commander-in-chief as a civilian. You don't want a military individual in charge of this. You need to have a civilian. And, you know, the error in that individual's thinking is to think that the military law was the first law. Now, it may have been the first legislation as they were developing and bringing together things because they were preparing for war and for the revolution. So, you know, he states that the law, military law, arose in 1775, which is just right before 1776. So they were already preparing for war, or if that is a correct statement, I'm not sure that it is.
Well, it doesn't mean it's above it. I mean, look at... it might have been the first law that was applied, you know.
But it was applied by the colonies.
Right, we the people, right.
And then Congress came together and took control of that, and the Continental Congress elected a president. 10 presidents over a period of 10 years, I guess, a little more than that actually. So some of them probably served a little longer than a year. However that works, I don't know. But the Continental Congress. Okay, was the authority, and they elected a president, and the president was the commander-in-chief of the military, and the Continental Congress, which again was collectively brought together by all the colonies through the Committees of Safety, wrote the law for the military. And it makes sense that would have been the first thing to write because they were preparing for war. But they also wrote a lot of other things to control the government at the time as time went on, but eventually, of course, they debated the Constitution and we became the United States of America.
Well, we're in a dangerous situation because of where we're at. And if you think that Trump doesn't understand common law, that's going to be a problem, because I know for a fact that he understands that they're going to be able, that they're going to have to use military tribunals on some of these people because we have this enemy.
Yeah, but they have no clue. I don't. Maybe they do, but I don't believe they do, because they are saying some things that maybe is mimicking things that they may not really even understand. But they have no clue concerning the Rules Enabled Act. They have no clue our separation, that we have nothing to do with Rome. We have nothing to do with Roman law. Roman law is just repackaged Justinian law, and Justinian law is only repackaged Babylonian law.
It's going to be easier to fall into a dictatorship if people don't have that understanding. If we're going to go into military tribunals, arrest congressmen and senators and these other officials that supposedly we elected, and most of them were not elected, they were selected, it's going to be very tempting for somebody like Trump to just never let go of the reins. That's the problem.
Well, yeah, and it's not going to, I don't think Trump will not let go of the reins, but it is a problem. We're going to fail. It's absolutely guaranteed that we are going to fail again if we don't fix this problem now. Our founding fathers, who were highly educated, looked very deeply into this, understood the problems of the world. We have the same problems today as we did then. We just have technology with it. But the bottom line is Washington and our founding fathers was crystal clear. You have parties, you're going to destroy this nation. It will not survive it. And look, 200 years later, we're at the brink of destruction. But by the grace of God, you know, we're able to come out of this thing. Because I tell you what, going back to 2016, I was ready, lock and load. I didn't see a solution. I didn't understand. Well, I knew I was just starting to see something in the Bible that kind of lays something out, that Leviathan would be judged in this world before the Lord came. So, you know, that came some hope, but I didn't understand how that would happen. And then when Trump ran for president, and in 2017, and you listen to what he's saying, you start to say, hey, this may be the salvation of our nation right here. And indeed, it has become so.
Well, it does seem like Trump has a certain confidence in that Trump card, that no matter what these judges and these other people say, that ultimately he's going to be able to bring them under his thumb, so to speak, by going into military tribunals, because they got evidence that they committed treason.
Well, military tribunals have got to be the way. I agree on that. And I do believe that you're probably right, that's what's going to take effect. Because after all, this is treason. It is subversion against the United States of America and the Constitution and the people at the highest levels, okay? So I do think that is going to happen. But nevertheless, here's the thing. Trump is not a lawyer. Okay, it's very difficult to change the mind of lawyers. Okay, because again, they've invested $250,000, $250,000 to go through law school and to become and to get their quote unquote license, and that license is for the purpose of acting inside of a civil law court. It has nothing to do with a common law court. But in any event, these lawyers, you know, they're all advisors. So a lot of what Trump is getting right now is a lot of advisors. He's playing off his own knowledge, of course, to some degree, but I don't know how much time he's got to read books, if he's still, you know, and again, if he reads the book Government by Consent, I do believe his eyes would be open, okay? And that's why we sent two of his sons the book.
So, excuse me.
Because, you know, we sent it to... you know, Trump Jr. and also to Barron.
On the call with Jr.
And if they read it, I think they'll really be able to influence their father. So that'll be helpful. And yeah, that's the other thing, reason why we sent all of the people around him. You know, some of those people are not lawyers, but a lot of them are. But look at it's going to be difficult to get the ear of Bondi, for instance, to some degree, because again, you know, immediately, you know, you start to look at this idea of common law and the truth about common law, and it is contrary to everything they've been taught from grammar school through high school and into college. Everything they've been taught, okay? So, but again, all we need is one or two or three people to actually read that book, see that who we are as a people. And I do believe they'll feel it that they have to really push this to the others who are around them, and look at they're all going to get the book at the same time. You know, I'll be mailing all 50 books out at the same time, so they'll all get the book at the same time, and hopefully they'll get some conversation. Hey, did you get this book? Did you see that paper? The Supreme Court, the presentment. Yeah, we're trying to get them to communicate and talk about this, and to start to realize that we've all been duped. We've been lied to.
Listen, I think that they do have a couple of people up there, even in the Supreme Court, and that know the Constitution. You know, they're a minority, though. And
yeah, but do they know the law?
You know, I don't know. You don't think what's his name, Thomas does?
Well, he may be one exception, yes. So to try to get his ear is another thing, because there are doorkeepers there. And that's why, well, again, I don't think that they're going to have a choice to ignore this paper. We sent them a presentment before. They didn't send it back. We didn't expect an answer because that's not how it works. Okay? But we were very clear on what we had to say. So now we're sending this other presentment with an order. With an order. Okay? So it's different. It's not just a presentment. It's an order. And matter of fact, let me read that order, and then we'll get into picking up on the people in the queue. Let me see where this is at. Let me open this up. Here's the order. This is the last page of the presentment, okay? Conclusion and order. We, the sureties of the peace, on behalf of all sovereign people of the United States, command the United States Supreme Court to obey the law of the land and declare the following findings to force all courts to open our courts of record. Declare natural law the law of the land. Nullify 28 U.S.C. subsection 2072. And that's what is part of the law that brings into power and authority rules enabling act. Nullify federal rules of criminal and civil procedure. Nullify federal rules of evidence. I mean, who are these people that they think that they can sit down and decide, well, we're not going to allow you to bring that evidence in. No, no, you can't bring that evidence in. I mean, they do this all the time. Who are these people? Who do they think they're administrative law judges. They're not even law judges, nor can they be a law judge. Because only the people are the law judge. It's called the jury. There is no way that they can be anything other than administrative processes. Nullify the federal rules of evidence. Nullify chancery courts. Acknowledge the rules of common law for courts of record. Acknowledge the rules of common law for equity courts. And it's not just courts of law that is be under the laws, the rules of common law. Also the equity courts, they're required. American jurisprudence lays it out. Open the courts of justice, also known as courts of record. Declare summary judgments in a court of record null and void. Acknowledge the proof of jurisdiction. Acknowledge that proof of jurisdiction must appear on the record. Okay? And then, of course, all of the people that we copied on this. So, okay, so anyway, it's going to be an interesting thing to see what happens, but I do not think that they can possibly, if we can get onto Rogan, if we can get onto Tucker, you know, at least get them talking about this, because there's a lot, look, I've listened to both of those guys, and they're full of a lot of errors when it comes to understanding our nation, of who we are as a people, where we come from. They're also, they don't understand even that we're a Christian nation, Tucker might, but to the degree that we understand it, to the fact that we are a natural law republic created under Israel, you know, like Israel, okay, with the way their government was, 1600 BC, okay. So if we get to them, then the word gets out. We also, with this list of people that we copied, okay, that should put a lot of pressure on the Supreme Court also, okay, that these people, President Trump, Vice President Vance, Attorney General Bondi, Chief of Staff Susie Wiles, Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller, Cash Patel with the FBI, Dan Bongino with the FBI, Director of DNI Tulsi Gabbard, CIA Director John Ratcliffe, and so on. You know, all these secretaries, and then certain congressmen and senators. Of course, Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House. Kennedy, he's really great out there. Jim Jordan. Anyway, I guess that's all I have to say on it. Okay, you ready for the cue here? You still with us, Gerard? Am I still here? Maybe I'm not here.
No, you're here. I hear you.
Thank you. Okay. All right. I guess I'll take it from there. We only got one person in the queue. We lost somebody. Anybody else wants to get into the queue? Star 601 on the phone and app of browser. You got a button there. Okay. Robert from Texas. You got the mic. Go right ahead.
Yes. Thanks a lot, John. I'm sort of on the opposite side of the spectrum on maybe how we attack this problem and get some remedy. Today's thought was, have you guys ever utilized the neighborhood watch programs? Those may be some people that are interested.
That's an offshoot of committees of safety to some degree, but they're very limited to what they do, their powers and authorities, the neighborhood watch. But again, it only has one direct focus, where the committees of safety would deal with that and many, many other things. They'd have subcommittees.
Yeah, what I'm looking at, though, is, you know, they only do something once a year, and most of them anyway, at least here in Texas. And I was just thinking those as a place to find candidates for committees of safety that can, you know, really focus on knowing first law.
What do you mean, candidates for committees of safety? You're talking about the candidates that the committees of safety could try to help to get into power by getting them onto the, you know, onto the ticket for running for office? Is that what you're saying? Or
I don't think office running is a primary concern. I think holding people to their oaths at the lowest level.
That's the job of the committee of safety.
I'm sorry?
That's the job of a committee of safety, is to hold these peoples to the fire, keep their feet to the fire. When they don't obey the law, to make notification to them, to let it be known that they're breaking their oaths, and then they need to change things, and if they refuse to listen, then we do a recall.
Right.
And yet, the two committees of safety have enough people to be able to run a recall.
Well, there's another route there, too, don't forget. That's why we tell everybody to get friendly and educate the sheriff. because the sheriff can go in and cause an indictment or an arrest for a public official who's not upholding his oath of office. That's a crime. You know, and so...
We could do an indictment, and that should remove them from office, although I've seen and heard of people that have been indicted and continue in their office, and I don't know how to get away with that.
Yeah, isn't that even in the Constitution?
No, it's not clear, but the common law is common sense.
Right. But, so anyway, the sheriff is very powerful, and he can deputize, and he can do a lot of stuff with a committee of safety if they work close together, you know?
Right. The committee of safety is sort of a little weak if they don't have the sheriff. I mean, there's a lot of things they can do, but they really can't. Like, for instance, the committee of safety working with the sheriff can serve, or and a deputy, whoever comes to the meetings, you know. They can serve the committee of safety can serve a writ quo warranto on a board and use the sheriff to have that serving and then pull it into the courts to remove them off from their seats. And so that's one way to take control of school boards, to take control of town boards, village boards, or any other boards that are out there.
I think it's kind of a symbiotic relationship, because I think a sheriff has a hard time cleaning up a county if he doesn't have a group of people behind him, and the committee of safety is the perfect thing. If he's got 50, 100, 200 people that are in the committee of safety that he's working with, and then he comes in with a problem.
He's got people to walk his papers.
That's right. That's right. It gives him some authority and clout. So it works both ways.
Absolutely. But the thing is, you know, like, for instance, my sheriff who passed away, he was a great sheriff. And he wasn't such a good sheriff when I first heard about him, but he became a patriot and he changed his whole mind because he got educated. And I'm very surprised because his under-sheriff, who became sheriff when he died and then ran for office and got elected as sheriff, you would think that his under-sheriff would have understood what he understood. But this guy is lost. I mean, he has no clue of what the job is. But we're going to bring him along. We're preparing. Hopefully the next meeting we're going to talk, our Dutchess County meeting, we're going to talk a little bit about maybe approaching the sheriff now. And approaching the sheriff means give him a copy of the book, Government by Consent. We've already done, you know, our paperwork. We've got a resolution done. We've got a charter done. We got a seal, so we'll put it together nice and neat and bind it and hand it off to the sheriff with a copy of Government by Consent book and also with a copy of maybe a couple copies of the handbook for sheriffs, because we have a handbook for sheriffs available now too. And let me just pop that open and then move in. Let's see, hang on a second. That would be under Welcome. Books by John Duresh. Okay, let's see. Common Law Handbook, Common Law. Here it is, County Sheriff's Common Law Handbook. So maybe about a half a dozen or four or five or whatever handbooks with the handbook to the sheriff. You go there with the first meeting, 5 or 10 minutes, to very short, and then leave them with all this literature. And tell them, hey, look, we'd like to talk about this and other things at our meeting in about 5 or 6 weeks or so. We'll give you a call and hopefully you come to our meeting and let's have a conversation. Now he's going to be, he's going to feel indebted into reading the books, or at least skimming through it and reading the literature. And he should understand very quickly, and hopefully we'll be able to change his thinking, unless he's a criminal. You know, if he's a criminal, we're not going to change him at all. But, and there are a lot of sheriffs out there that are really bad. I don't know if I can say a lot, but there are sheriffs out there that are bad. And they're corrupt because they're political and they're stuck with the rest of the political process that they live in. But anyway, we're empowering him. The guy should read, if he reads this stuff, he should realize, hey, I got a lot more power than I realized. And I can, I should be doing these things. But again, when we have that conversation with him at the second meeting, and he doesn't say and do the right thing, c'est la vie, Sheriff, because we're going to do a recall on him, and we'll get another guy, another sheriff in town. And that'll be that. But hopefully we'll turn him. And I think we can turn most sheriffs, because I think most sheriffs are just ignorant. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Let's go to Robert here. Robert, you got anything else here?
What I'm trying to do, we are looking for a man or men to do for us what only God can do through us. So it's like David. He didn't go talk to the king or talk to the judges or talk to the whoever. We've got our founders totally sold out for God. And each of the men that got in the fight were using God as their weapon. So when we try to, you know, like our sheriff is corrupt. He drove the tank at the Branch Davidian when it was set ablaze and barbecued all those people. And he had 13 peace officers and a trial on that about speaking out at court in public participation. I'll be going to that tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock again for the sentencing part of it. But anyway, the whole deal is all of our people here, you know, they're trying to write bills. They're trying to get man to do for us what only God can do through each of us. And I've approached you before about, you know, the elementary schools and the mothers and the Bibles and getting them in the fingers of four-year-olds. You know, Benjamin Rush read the Bible when he was 4 years old, I'm told. I'm just trying to aggregate some people. It can show up at commissions, councils, and boards. We don't have to rely on knowing anybody there. You know, we get 3 minutes to speak. And if we get 10 people, that's 30 minutes. And we can bring the word of God, which is laws of nature, nature's God. You know, we are really protest ants. We're not constitutionalists, because that is written by man, the Constitution. Laws of nature, nature's God, are written by God. So I like to call myself a Protestant or a declarationist more than a constitutionalist. And I just, you know, God gave our founders all the power, and he can put the words in our mouths and on our lips. And the places, you know, I think we could find people that are interested in their own physical safety, but they also have to be interested in the safety of the foundation of their laws. That's creation in the Bible. And that sort of, you know, wipes out all these bills. Man is trying to write bills to protect against abortion. Well, the Declaration already does that. Man is trying to write bills to make parents have say over what their children are learning. That's already written in the Bible. You know, and that's the foundation of our law. So, you know, I'm sort of the opposite. I'm not reaching for the Supreme Court or Trump, or even though John Ratliff knows who I am. I used to broadcast him live when he was just a representative. And, you know, Paxton follows me, Charlie Kirk follows me, Ted Cruz follows me, and, you know, other important senators. And anyway, we have 3,142 counties. If we could get a dozen people speaking into each of those on a topic that is particularly important, and that's basically following the Constitution. You know, there's a lot of things that Trump does that sound good to us. He's attacking the issues that we want to solve, but he's doing it in an unconstitutional way. And the only way we can have any remedy with the help of God through us, is if we fight for his laws as are laid out in the Declaration, and which they...
How is he doing it outside the Constitution?
I'm sorry, what?
You said that he's not doing it the constitutional way. How is he not... abiding to the Constitution? What's he doing that is in conflict?
Yeah, he did that anti-Semitism thing, so you couldn't speak bad about Jews. And then about 2 weeks later, 10 days, you know, he made, you can't speak bad about Christians. Well, our freedom of speech.
Well, I don't think that he, no, he was talking about what was going on in the colleges and in the schools and the people, you know, trying to prevent the people who were Jews, you know, to come into the school. And it was a lot of people that really came in here from other countries and were coming in, going to the college, and they were the one causing problems. So that's what he was talking about. But no, you could say anything you want against a Jew or a Christian or anybody, okay? But to go in and prevent people from, you know, going to school, which is really what that thing was all about. I don't know that he ever said anything that you can't say anything bad about Jews or you can't say right. anything about Christians. I don't think, you know, as a, you know, across the board kind of thing. We do on the Bible, though, because we did a memorandum here, and the case was Engel versus Vitale, which took the Bible out of schools. And that is another thing that we, you know, it's part of our agenda. We have a lot of things we need to work on. We have to start with the beginning and get in power first by establishing the committees of safety, working things out with the sheriff, start taking control of our schools, going to school boards, removing school boards if they're not going to obey the people. And we should be able to grow very quickly. You know, we should be able to get 100 people in the committee of safety. Once the committee of safety is established and you start to go and start to take back the schools, you're going to grow leaps and bounds at that point because parents are going to come and get involved and they're going to see what we're doing and see the plan, and then they're going to go to the school board with us, and we're going to blow them out of the water, and we're going to remove them if they're not going to be obedient and take all this crap out of the schools. You look at these school boards are supposed to be doing the will of the people, okay? They should have a proper education. They shouldn't be demoralizing our children. It's the people who decide these things. The sovereign. But getting Bible in the school is another thing that we must do. We have to do it because how can you acknowledge the king of the court, who is Jesus Christ, because that's who the king of the court is. You know, we the people, you know, we are the ones that are the jury, whether it be a grand jury or trial jury, but let's say the trial jury. We're on the trial jury. We have to come with a sense of honor, justice, and mercy. We have to, and where does the law come from? It comes from God. And how did God give us the law? He wrote it into our hearts. That's how, and put it into our minds. So we already know the law. Goodness, take the Ten Commandments, lays it out pretty clearly, the basics of law. You know, we know when someone has been injured by another individual, and if there was intent, we can tell if they intended on doing it or if they didn't have intent. Because if it didn't have intent, then there's no crime. It'd still be liable, but there's no crime. And so we know when a wrong is done, or being done, and we also know what to do to fix this problem. Okay, we need to restore the person that has been injured. And we can go to biblical principles. You know, you steal a man's ox, you got to give him back four, or whatever the case may be. Okay, and there's a few different principles throughout the Bible that gives us as far as restoring someone. And the process of restoring helps to really bring the person who did the injury back into the fold, so to speak, back into society, and hopefully come to realize that the suffering and pain that they did upon a person that they, you know, somehow injured. So, but we agree definitely the Bible's got to be in the schools and got to get it back. And there is I wrote a memorandum. It's quite a long one, too. I think it's like about 12 pages. And it lays out even how we should go about how they used the Bible in the past and how we can use it again. Okay. So
we have a bill here in Texas that's about to pass to put the Ten Commandments into every classroom. The problem is they're kind of forcing it rather than using God through our lips to explain why it should be there. And the main argument for getting Ten Commandments or the Bible back into school is, you know, Blackstone's most famous quote was, no human law should be suffered to contradict creation in the Bible. And so we've got 9,000 bills that were submitted this year, and I would say at least 99% of them violate creation in the Bible. So anyway, I did want to, I did some proofreading on the elected and appointed servants handbook, and I'll just say them here and then we can replay and know where they are. Page 38, bottom paragraph, page 40, top paragraph, page 41. There's two italicized paragraphs that are identical. One's near the top, one's near the bottom. They're four lines long. And on page 42, the bottom paragraph isn't real clear to me. So anyway, I've got that on the record.
Yeah, if you could, just send an email to mail at nationallibertyalliance.org. Just put in the subject matter, error in whatever the book is, and then give us the info. And anybody else that could do that, we'd appreciate it, because I can get up there and change and make corrections. And I've written so much, there's got to be errors. I mean, I'm not error-free. I don't know anybody who can say
it's a fantastic book. I want to get it published. I want to buy multiple copies and, use that as part of my spiel. Now, as far as the email goes, I'm in a problem with, I'm using packet mail from my first ISP. I've sent two of them this past week to relay this information, and I haven't received any response.
Okay, well, I didn't see it, but I don't see a lot of things because I get a lot of mail. But, I do breeze through the subject line, and so when I see subject lines that I think I should open, I'll look at it because I just can't keep. Sometimes I'll go almost through a whole week without even checking my email, because I'm just so too tied up. I know Jan takes care of some of this stuff, and Terry takes care of some of this stuff, but anything comes in on a handbook or any of my books that there's an error somewhere that needs correction, as long as you put an error in book, whatever the book is, and then give the information in the email, I will pick up on that.
Okay, well, and I'm having trouble with email too, so at least at 9:45 p.m. on Monday, I at least got it on audio that page 38, 40, 41, and 42
okay.
I've got some problems with.
All right, I appreciate it. And anybody sent anything in for a correction, try to be specific, so I know what I'm looking for. All right, anything else, Robert?
Oh, that'll do for now, but, I think, we had the freedom of speech, and they have to listen at our commission councils and boards.
Mm-hmm.
And if we get a dozen people going into each of those, especially on the Bible, because the students
will fill the room. We will, look at anybody who follows the procedure and the process that we put together in the handbooks. When it comes to dealing with the boards, we did video on this too, which you can find under the handbook page. We will be there and fill that room up, okay?
Let's do it.
Those people, it is their duty to respond to the people. This is their children. This is our community, and this is what we want. Just because you're a board member doesn't give you free will to do anything you want. You need to do our will. And that's the attitude and the conversation we have to have with these people. And we have to have the sheriff with us to serve a writ quo warranto should they decide to not listen and give us a hard time or try to shut us down. Then we'll just remove them from their positions.
Okay. And one last real quick thing on getting rid of parties. I have this badge that I wear everywhere, and it says it's not left or right, Republican or Democrat. It's right or wrong, and you just can't believe how many people comment about my pen. So that's the interest and enthusiasm and the agitation and the anger is out there that we just have a uniparty now, and we need to get it back to God and doing the right thing.
Absolutely, look, we should all be Republicans, okay? But we really can't try to push that idea or thought because people will attach the party to that and see something different. So, look, I think the way, if we're going to use a word on who we are as the people, we have to be constitutionalists. Let's just talk about the Constitution. That's what we elected those people to do, is to deal and obey the Constitution. So we give you your powers, we give you your authorities, you go read it in there, you stay within that criteria, and then and don't go outside of it, and we're all good, okay? But we got to find some way to. I think we have a great opportunity because the Democratic Party has imploded, and I think we have the opportunity to just get rid of parties. Right now, we can do it. People are, you know, ignorant to the truth and what's going on here and don't understand to think that we can't survive without political parties. The truth of the matter is we can't survive with political parties because that's just one group against the other, right, left, right, left, right, left, and every time you turn around, you're losing more liberty and they're taking more power and authority and they just go on and on. They actually debate our right to have a weapon. They debate our right to free speech. Who the heck are these people? We need to be all constitutionalists. Back to the Constitution. Right. And that hopefully would be the word that could, you know, survive the idea to get rid of parties.
Yeah.
Well, and you know what is the other thing? If you don't have parties, these people that we send to Congress, they have nothing else to do but to do the will of their constituents. Right?
That's the scam that they're playing. They filed 9,000 bills so they can make money for their lobbyists and the people that are pushing their, you know, their issues so they can make more money. It's they got to do it for God. They got to enforce the laws of God as was prescribed in the first, second, third sentences of the Declaration and for which the, you know, Constitution was written. The Bible inspired the Declaration, which required the Constitution to protect our faith. That's the way we got to go on this thing. Bible
right,
Declaration.
We're at the clock right now, so we got to move. We've got one other person in the queue. So,
okay.
Thanks a lot, Robert.
Yeah.
And I know we'll be talking again. Gerard, you want to take the last call here? Are you back yet?
Yeah, I'm here.
I'll hit the button to take the next call. This is the last one, so.
Okay.
Francini, you got the mic. Francini from New York. Away from her computer.
Put her to sleep, maybe.
Hello, Francini from New York. Okay, well, you got anything to talk about while we wait to see if she wakes up?
Oh, I don't know. There's a lot to talk about. You know, we're getting down to...
The First Amendment states, Congress shall make no law respecting the an establishment of religion or forbidding the free exercise thereof. Didn't they go and make a law in Engle versus Vitale? Removing the Bible out of school. Anyway, back to you.
Are you saying that that law said that they took the Bible out of school, or was that to you?
Well, yeah, the case, Engle versus Vitale, the Supreme Court ruled that the Bible had to be removed from school. I think that was in 63 or 62. I remember I was in school at the time. And,
really? And the Supreme Court let that stand?
Oh, yeah, you can't bring the Bible into school. We're gonna go up against that next. Well, maybe not next, but it's on our list. You know, we have a lot of things we have to go and correct in the courts. And first of all, we got to get to back our courts of record in the federal courts. And once we get into federal courts, then these judges are supposed to be champions of the Constitution. So when a state court is not being obedient to opening a court of justice and allowing courts of records to proceed, then we can use the federal court to hammer them down and require them to open those courts. And we've got a lot of changes and a lot of work to do here in the courts.
Listen, that goes against precedent because in the beginning, Bible was school. They used the Bible to teach the kids.
Yes, reading and everything, yeah.
In the beginning, so they and now they're telling us we have to take it out. Well, our precedent and our first.
You sound surprised by that. You're not surprised by that, right?
No, I'm not. But I'm surprised that it stood in '63. I guess we were farther gone than I thought.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Or somebody just didn't bring it. So somebody should have challenged this and brought it to the Supreme Court and made it. See, the worst thing you could do is remain silent, and that's what happened here. The people that should have been screaming about this did not.
Well, I don't think, well, First of all, people don't understand the process on how to use the Bible in school. There is a process. And because I was wondering, well, okay, you know, we got to be careful that people aren't in there denominizing people, you know, bringing up, you know, different, what would you call it?
Dogma.
Doctrines, yeah, dogma or doctrines of men or doctrines of their churches and so on and so forth. We have to, there is a criteria and there is a way that it is to be used properly. And just like anything else a teacher does, they should be instructed on how to go forward with things, you know, and just on how to bring the Bible in is, again, how it should go forward with it. So, as a matter of fact, I cover that in this memorandum. So, and this memorandum is in the Government by Consent book, and it's also in a book I wrote, Memorandums of Lore, which I think was 30 memorandums altogether in that book. And the purpose of that book, in fact, this is that book, the purpose of that book really is to lay out all of the main major problems in our courts and the solutions, Memorandum of Common Law. And these are the memorandums in this book.
Yep.
Francine, did you get back yet? Oh, I think she's still sleeping.
Yeah. Well, we're down to the minute, so.
You got a final comment or anything?
No, I don't have a comment short enough to finish in a minute.
Oh, you got 3 minutes. Come on.
Yeah. I don't know. Every day I wonder, you know, how far it's going to go before it reaches ahead.
All right. Well, I guess we come to the end of our program. Make one more note of something I brought up in the beginning of the call here. You know, we are doing... we're sending a paper, of course, to the Supreme Court. It's an extraordinary paper concerning the Rules Enabling Act in order to bring back our courts of justice. I got a call from a member today who has been supporting us with considerable amounts of money as time gone on, and he's offering to put up $1,000. He's looking for the people to meet that $1,000. So if anybody can do $5, $20, $50, whatever you can do to try to meet that $1,000 goal, and he's placing up $1,000. So that'd be very helpful for what we're doing here, because things cost money and got to come from somewhere, and I don't have deep pockets. But anyway... Okay, I see Brett came into the queue here. We'll give you 1 minute, Brett, because it is now 11:01, and we need to close down in a minute or two. But you got the mic, Brett. Go right ahead. 1 minute or two.
Hello?
Yep, you got it.
Thank you. I was just wondering, as a next friend, how would I start out with the paperwork as a next friend, the body? I know, okay. Challenging jurisdiction, it would be your name, one of the people of Wisconsin, but how for the next friend?
Yeah, you refer to the next friend as a code, and you put it into a footnote. I am working on a paper of a dear friend of mine who passed away, and the family would like to continue that court case that I was doing for him, or with him, shall I say. But I was writing the papers, and I'm going to come in and announce myself as the representative of the family, and I'll be doing that and building up the position of next friend. So if you want, once I get that paper going, which I think I'm going to work on that this week, because I have to notify the court of his passing, and I have to notify the court of our continuation, and by what power and authority we are able to continue by, and by what power or authority that I have to come into this court of record, which is a common law court, it's not a civil law court, so people don't have to be a bar attorney in a common law court. Maybe in a civil law court they'd like that to happen, because they created this fictional court that is repugnant to the Constitution. But nevertheless, even there, there's a federal code that permits us to be able to go in and represent ourselves and represent a group if we come in, and if a person's able to be coherent in the paperwork. And that's one of the big problems. You know, people don't have that background and that experience of writing papers, and so they're unable to really express themselves clearly, and they get very confused. And I know in the beginning, I know I was confusing and I wasn't expressing myself clearly. But, you know, with time and study and reading other cases and seeing other examples and so on and so forth, you become better and better and better and better and better at writing papers. So anyway, I can get you something on that on the next friend, maybe next week. If you hit me up on it, I might have it already.
Okay, thank you. And how should I follow up with you?
Well, come to the Monday night meeting and just ask if I did anything. And I'll probably, what I may do is I may post it up anyway under one of our law pages where people can go up and, you know, so they can learn how to do something like what I'm going to do. Serve notice of appearance, for instance, which I've done before. In a town court, I served a notice of appearance, and I'm going to serve a notice of appearance. And under the rules, federal rules that permit, next friend, and by what authorities?
Okay, could habeas corpus be done by next friend?
Habeas corpus? Yes, of course. Well, it depends. Is the person in jail?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, you can come in as with an affidavit and come in with the paperwork for that. I'll give you, let me see, you can go up to our page right now and get some info on that. Come under Education Starts Here, come down to Law, and then you come over to Court Forms and Process, and Control Find Habeas. It'll go here. Habeas corpus, instructions and forms to file habeas corpus. So we have it in PDF and we have it in Word. Okay, so you can start there. And next week I'll give you if that's what you're doing, that's all you're going to need right there. But I'm going to bring up that other paper if I can get it done by next week. I think I should be able to, because I got to file it in the courts. So I'll show you how to set up, the appearance, notice of appearance to file into the courts, and in this case also I've got to bring an affidavit together concerning the will of the family to go forward with the course, and by what power and authority that can happen by continue the court case.
Okay.
All right, we got to close down. We're 4 minutes over.
I'm sorry?
We're 4 minutes over, so we got to shut down. We'll talk again next week if you want.
Okay, yeah, thank you. Okay. We'll talk next week.
Okay, Brett. All right, Dennis. Ends. Thanks for everyone coming, and Lord willing, hopefully we'll see you all next Monday. We'll be back. Good night, everybody.